Intro to Cascading Style Sheets. What is CSS? First of all, CSS is not a subset of HTML or a different kind of HTML. In fact, CSS also works with other kinds of markup, like SGML and XML. CSS is a separate beast altogether, designed to address a separation of concerns. In software, the separation of concerns is a principle for good design. It means that software should be divided up into modules, or different sections, so that each section deals with a different set of ideas. Again, we're seeing how semantics, or meaning, plays a role in software development. Software is written for computers, but it's human beings who have to write and maintain it. The concerns at stake in web page markup are structure, which is handled by HTML, and presentation, the problem solved by cascading style sheets. History of CSS. CSS was first proposed back in 1994, but style sheets weren't a new idea. Computer scientists had known for a while that it was best to separate structure from presentation. The first versions of HTML allowed developers to include style attributes, but using HTML attributes for style generally led to messy, complicated code that was hard to read and difficult to maintain. Click through to read about the different versions of CSS. CSS 1. The first CSS specification was released in December 1996. Basic alignments, colors, text properties, and positioning of HTML elements were included. Even this was a welcome addition to web developers' toolboxes. CSS 2. Introduced in May 1998, CSS 2 added more advanced element positioning, media types, and some accessibility features. CSS 2.1 came a bit later, and it was not published as a recommended standard until 2011. In many ways, it was a bug fix release. It was thought, too, that CSS 2.1 would be the last version in the CSS 2 line, but CSS 2.2 fixes more bugs in the CSS 2 specification. The CSS 1 and CSS 2 specifications are no longer maintained. You will still find CSS 1 and CSS 2 features supported in modern web browsers, but no more work is being done on the specifications. Some work continues on CSS 2.2. CSS 3. Released in 1998, this is the latest version that is widely supported by modern web browsers. Recent versions of modern browsers will support most or all of CSS 3's selectors. More on those soon. These browsers will also cover all of CSS 1 and 2. This means that if you load a page that uses, for example, CSS 2's features, you'll be fine, even though CSS 3 is the latest version. CSS 3 broke the CSS specification into modules. This means that different parts of CSS are being developed under their own individual specifications that are at different levels of completeness, but still CSS 3 is very widely implemented. These specifications are backwards compatible, meaning that they can still work with earlier versions of CSS. CSS 4. CSS 4 is also currently being developed. Many current browsers only support about half or less than half of CSS 4's features, though. CSS 4 is also modularized. If you're developing a site or application, and you're absolutely certain that the CSS 4 features you want to use will be available, then you can use those features. For now, though, most developers will be using CSS 3. CSS allows developers to clearly separate presentation from structure in a way that is sensible, maintainable, and pretty powerful. Using CSS, a developer can create intriguing shapes and animations that contribute to effective user interfaces. Power always comes with some complication, and CSS is no exception. But basic CSS is easy to get started with. How to add CSS to an HTML document. Before we get into how CSS works, let's see how CSS is added to an HTML document. There are several ways to add CSS to your documents, and they have their own pros and cons. Inline. Inline styles are added by using the style attribute in an HTML element that you wish to style. This is a fast and easy way to style a document, which is great for experimenting. This type of styling reduces the number of HTTP requests. This is the most specific way to style an HTML element. Here we see two CSS style properties that will change the presentation of this cheesy heading. That's really all there is to it. The property comes first, then a colon, and the value. Multiple pairs are separated by semicolons. It's not a great idea to use inline styles, though, because they're so specific and they're buried in the HTML file itself. They violate the separation of concerns principle. That means that inline styles are going to be more difficult to debug and to maintain. Very occasionally, there will be a good argument for using an inline style. Sometimes this is just because you want to try something out quickly. That's fine. Sometimes, too, you'll want to change only one element on a page, and you won't want to modify an external CSS file. That can work, but mostly it's best to avoid inline CSS in HTML files on a live production website. Internal style sheets are added to an HTML document with the style element. These style sheets apply to the entire HTML document and not just to specific HTML elements. We'll see what this means in a moment. For an internal style sheet, the style tag is placed in the head element of an HTML document, and then CSS rules are added within the style element. Here's an example. Here we see a style element which will apply to the entire web page. In this case, that means that the P elements, all of them, will be styled according to the style sheet's rules, partly because the style sheet is internal. We'll talk more about rules and how they work, and how they can be made more specific, even within an internal or external style sheet, in the next lesson. Internal style sheets are a distinct improvement over inline styles. All the styles are located in one place, and there's a real separation between structure and presentation. But there could be even more separation. When a style sheet is within the HTML document, it increases the size of the document and is downloaded repeatedly whenever the page loads. Internal style sheets can be useful, especially when you're making a template, but they still have limitations. External style sheets are often the method of choice for connecting styles to a document. The idea is simple. Put all your styles into one file, or more depending upon how complex your site is, and then link that file within the HTML document. This document is easy to find. Other developers will know exactly where to look to find your styles. Because the styles are in their own file, that file can be cached. The web browser will download the file once, but unless it's necessary for some reason, the style sheet won't be downloaded again. This cuts down on HTML document sizes and makes a website just a little faster. This also makes the site more flexible. Different style sheets are easier to link to different pages, and the styles don't have to be repeated if the web developer designs the site carefully. Finally, a single style sheet can manage multiple pages of a site, or often entire sites. Styles remain consistent, and code is much easier to manage. In order to link an external style sheet, all that's necessary is to include a link tag in the head of your HTML document. The link element imports the style sheet named main.css. The browser then applies the styles normally, as long as the style sheet was downloaded without any trouble. The main.css file will contain the styles specified as with the internal style sheet, but there will be no style tag in that file. Only the CSS rules will be included. Imported. Finally, imported style sheet files allow you to pick up styles from within other style sheet files. This practice can allow developers to make their CSS styles smaller and even more modular. Styles can be imported from remote locations, too. Say you have a selection of styles that you use repeatedly located in a file called library.css. You want to add your paragraph style, but don't want to copy and paste all of the styles from library.css. One way to do this would be to create a file. We'll call it custom-style.css. Just for the sake of example, and add these contents to it. As long as the library.css file is in the same directory, it will be imported into the custom-style.css file. You can also specify a URL if you like, and you have access to one. This is just an example. For this to work, imported rules should be the first rules in a CSS file. Imported styles take more planning than the other types because they need more organization, and knowing how best to organize the code isn't always obvious. This might mean that the initial development is slower, but the benefits of this style outweigh that little lag in organizational time. Rules, selectors, and specificity. Okay, we've had glimpses of CSS here and there so far. Let's take a deeper look at how CSS rules work and how they can be applied to an HTML document. CSS rules. It's time for some new terminology. Within the style element, we see a CSS rule. Specifying rules is how we change the presentation of HTML elements. A rule is made up of a selector and a declaration block. The selector specifies an HTML element to which the styles will apply. A rule might have one selector, or it might have a few, as we'll see. A declaration block contains a number of declarations, which are property value pairs. Each property describes how the element will be styled, and the accompanying value describes how much, like so. In this case, H1 is the selector. This style will be applied to all H1 elements in the document. The declaration block is defined by the curly braces that surround the set of declarations. Each declaration is separated from the others by a semicolon. So in the HTML document to which this style applies, the text within an H1 element will be blue, 20 pixels high, italic, and bold. All of the declarations within a declaration block are applied at once. Selectors, specificity, and inheritance. We've seen an example of using an element selector, affecting the presentation of an element by matching that element with a selector. But you can become much more specific if you wish to, and you will often wish to. Let's take a look at different kinds of selectors. ID selector. With an ID selector, you can apply styling to an element by specifying its ID value, like this. Because an element's ID attributes should be unique in a document, this is a frequent way to apply a style rule to a single element on a page. Class selector. Sometimes you'll want to select elements by their class attributes value, like so. This allows you to choose a set of, for example, H2 elements that are performing a similar role and therefore might have the same class value. Other H2 elements, though, won't be affected if they have no class value or different class values. Pseudo class selector. Pseudo class selectors allow you to apply styling to an element according to its state. For example, if you're hovering over a P element, you can change the element styling by applying this selector. You can select an element by specifying many different states. You can select empty elements, elements that are last in a list, or first, link elements that haven't been clicked. The list goes on. Because these elements can enable very special behaviors too, you'll find them often in more advanced web applications. ID selector. You can select an element by the element's ID attribute. The ID attribute is a way of giving a specific HTML element a unique identifier. So you shouldn't have two elements, or more, with the same ID. The ID attribute is very simple to apply. Just give the ID a unique, meaningful name. Now this can be styled by using a selector with the hashtag syntax, like so. Alternatively, you can specify the element itself, too, to be even more precise. Class selector. The class attribute works the same way as the ID attribute. Class attributes are meant to be a little more general, though. You can have multiple elements in a document with the same class value. Now those elements can be selected with the dot syntax, just like we used hash for IDs. Or, pseudo class selector. Pseudo class selectors give you the ability to affect elements based on their current state or status. Pseudo is a prefix that means fake or apparent. So pseudo classes might only temporarily apply to an element. These are very useful. For example, with pseudo class selectors, you can change an element's appearance only when someone is hovering over the element with the mouse. You can also say change an element like a checkbox when it's checked, or a list item when it's the first in the list. Pretty powerful stuff. There are many pseudo classes. You'll have to use a reference, like Mozilla's developer index, to become acquainted with them all. They're used with the colon syntax. Notice that in the above example, there's no special attribute. In other words, there is nothing that tells us that this element can be part of a pseudo class like we saw for class or ID. Pseudo classes specify what state or status the element will have. So this selector will select, and therefore affect, the above link when the mouse is hovering over it. Again, there are many pseudo classes, and you'll need to get familiar with them. Ancestors and descendants. Sometimes you'll want to select an element if and only if it's the descendant of another element, meaning that it's contained within or is wrapped by another element. A descendant specifically refers to any element that is contained by another element, even if the descendant is a few levels down. Conversely, an element is another element's ancestor if it contains the other element, even if it's a few levels up. When two elements are at the same level, neither one contains the other, then we say those elements are siblings. Take a look at this code, for example. In this example, the section tag is the P tag's and the M tag's ancestor. The P and M tags are descendants of the section tag. Here we have the word extreme contained within an M element, which indicates that the content should be styled in order to indicate emphasis. The default styling is italic. Let's say we want to change the M element style when it's within a section element. In this case, the M element is also within a P element, but that's okay. The M element is still a descendant of the section element. A relevant descendant selector would look like this. The element selectors are simply separated by a space. It's understood that the element that comes later is supposed to be a descendant of the one that comes before it. Now let's say we want to change the style only when the M element is in the bio section of the document. In this case, the M element is a descendant of the section element with the ID attribute of bio. So we can combine ID and descendant selectors like so. We can start to see how powerful this is. The different kinds of selectors can be combined for varying levels of specificity. Specificity and inheritance. CSS is pretty easy to understand, but it can get complicated fast. When your HTML document becomes large and complex, and the site is very stylized, a norm for most sites these days, tracking down CSS problems can become a daily chore. One reason for this is because more specific selectors override selectors that are less specific. Perhaps you've got a specific style for a P element that generally should be followed throughout the whole site, but you have an exception for certain P elements. Say the special P elements look like this. The style sheet might have this. Notice that it seems like there is conflicting information here. How does CSS decide which one to apply? The text within the p.description element will be assigned a size of 9 pixels. This is because the p.description selector is more specific than the P selector. In this example, this is pretty straightforward, but there will be cases where it's not as obvious. In those cases, the CSS selector's level 3 standard tells us how to determine how specific a selector is. Let's look at a simplified version. Say you have the following code. To figure out how specific your rule would need to be in order to style the birth date in this example, you break down this code by analyzing it for 4 components: tag, ID, class, and element. For this little exercise, consider the entire code example. You are going to count how many of the selectors specified below are in that item of code and record them in a table to determine the specificity of that item. Your table looks like this. Selector, A, tag style attribute, B, ID, C, class, D, element, specificity. Looking at our code, let's place a value in each column according to the following rules. A. If the CSS declaration is in the style attribute of an HTML tag, then this column gets a 1. Every other column will get a 0, so the resulting number will be 1000. That's as high as our scale goes, and that's as specific as we get. B. Count the number of ID selectors in the entire example. That number goes here. C. Count the number of class selectors or pseudo-class selectors in the entire example. That number goes here. D. Count the number of element selectors in the entire example. Pop that number in here. Place all of your digits from the table in order from left to right to form a number. The resulting number measures how specific your overall selector is. The higher the number, the more specific the selector. And whichever selector is the most specific is the one that is applied. Try this before you look at the examples. Here's a table with some examples. So the bottommost selector in the table is the most specific selector. An element that was styled by this selector would override a less specific selector, and the appropriate styles would be applied. When we talk about inheritance, we're referring to a large part of what we mean by cascading in cascading style sheets. In general, elements inherit CSS declarations from their ancestor elements. For example, let's say we have this style sheet. Generally, the text in the document will be formatted as Times New Roman with a size of 14 pixels. Any text within a P element that has the class IntroText will also be 14 pixels Times New Roman, but also will be italic. That's because the body element will always be an ancestor of any P element. So the P element will inherit the body element's CSS properties where it makes sense to do so. Some CSS properties are inherited, and some aren't. There's no quick and dirty way to say which properties will be inherited, but you can usually trust your instincts. It makes sense for text properties to be inherited, but a container's background image property won't be. If you're unsure about whether a property will be inherited, you'll have to refer to the CSS standard or refer to a good resource online. It's not too hard to see that inheritance and selector specificity will be ideas that interact with each other from time to time. Inheritance, though, will become pretty instinctive pretty quickly, and you'll see how this behavior is really a feature of CSS, making styles easier to manage. Also, there are ways to manage inheritance behavior. Again, you'll become familiar with these techniques as you develop your skills. Properties and attributes. We've sort of glossed over common CSS properties and the values that they can take. Let's talk about properties and values for a moment just to clarify a few details. Any HTML element has its own set of CSS properties that can have values applied to them. Again, some common sense is going to apply here. Much depends on what an element is supposed to do on the page and how it might be logically styled. Often, it will make sense to consult a reference for any particular HTML element so that you can confirm what properties are available to you and which values they can take. As we work through activities, you'll be given a range of properties and values, but you should always be willing to investigate by consulting the standards. Thinking outside, also inside and around, the box. We're going to be doing some layout in CSS, but in order to do that, we'll need to understand how browsers build boxes. Essentially, every HTML element represented on a web page can be thought of as being contained by a box. Usually, these are invisible boxes, rectangular allotments of space that the element sits within. The boxes have a set of consistent properties. Let's take a look. The CSS box model. Any HTML element's box has four essential properties to be aware of: the content area, padding, border, and margin. You can influence the size of all of these things. The content area of a box is the actual area that contains the element's content. There's nothing surprising here. The height and width CSS properties control the size of the content area. The padding is a transparent area that surrounds the content area. You'll use the padding top, padding bottom, padding left, and padding right properties to set padding size. There's also a shorthand property called padding that allows you to set all sides at once. A border surrounds the padding area, and just like all of these areas, its width can be altered for design purposes. Finally, a margin area surrounds the border. If you wish to calculate the size of the box, you'll need to add together the height or width of the content area and then tack on the sizes of the padding, border, and margin. Boxes and the ideas related to them come up repeatedly in CSS. We'll see these properties often. Tables. Data has a harder punch when it's easier to read. Let's learn by example and start off with a table that needs a little TLC. We're applying one style to make this easy to view. Check out our table. Not too exciting, eh? But notice that there are three new elements introduced here. The caption and T-head elements help make the table more semantically rich. The caption element serves to provide a label for the table. This element must always be the first child of a table element. The T-head element defines a table's header. The T-head tag must always come after the caption tag. The T-body element comes after the T-head and defines the table's primary data rows. Remember that for any site, semantic coding should be a priority because it makes your data easier to understand. More tags will make styling the table a little easier. First, let's make the table a little more readable by adjusting the spacing and the borders. There are a few things to explain. You'll need to know what a sibling element is. Elements are siblings if they're both children of the same parent. Table. Here are some details about the properties. Border collapse. Normally, a table has a little space between the cells. The amount of space can be controlled, but unless you have a reason for including this space, it's really not necessary and can be a pain to style. The collapse value here eliminates that separation, which is usually a good idea. Table layout. The fixed value sizes the table according to the widths of the first row of cells. This solves some issues with default table sizing. The short story is that tables can do some funny things by default. Also, if we specify how the table should be sized, the browser has to do less work. The table will load faster, which, with a really huge table, could be a real feature. Width. We've seen this one before, but here we're using a percentage as a value for the attribute. The percentage indicates how much the table will fill an enclosing container. In this case, the enclosing container is the body element, so this table will fill 70% of the body's width. Whether that width is set by default, by the browser, or explicitly in CSS. A percentage also means that the table will automatically resize when the container around it resizes. Nth child. The nth child pseudo-class selector allows you to specify an element based on the order it comes in compared to its siblings. The number associated with the nth child selector is how the sibling's position is specified. Here, we've used percentages to set the widths of the first, second, and third columns. The first and second columns get 28% of the available space each. The third column, which has relatively short content, gets just 12% of the total available space. THTD. Just a couple of properties here. Border. Here we see a shorthand property where a few values are being set at once. The width in pixel units, the line style, and the color. The line style and color values are examples of allowable keywords. Padding. The padding property is right from our box model. In this case, each table cell is a box, and inside that box, between the content and the border, is our padding. In this case, we set the padding to 10 pixels all around the inside of the cell, top, bottom, and sides. Now our table looks like this. This is a nice improvement, but we can do better still. The caption needs to be improved. The show names could be aligned so that they're at the top of the cell, and the starting years could be aligned so they're centered. Finally, maybe we can add some kind of coloring to make everything look a little nicer. Here is our additional CSS. The caption rule includes the text align property, which can have values like left, center, and right. Here, we'll move the caption over to the left. We'll couple that with the shorthand font property and specify a 36-pixel bold caption. The TD rule will make every cell in the table position its content starting at the top by using the vertical align property. We have another nth child pseudo class selector that works with TD elements in the third column. Again, if this is confusing, remember that the nth child pseudo class will, in this case, select every third sibling. Because TD elements represent columns in a row, that means the third column will be selected. For this third column, we center align the text. In this TH selector, we set a background color property to black. The effect will be what you expect. You might think, though, that text color would be set with a text color property, but there is no such thing. Instead, just use the color property. Finally, we introduce a twist to the nth child pseudo class. In addition to numbers, this selector can also take even or odd keywords. By specifying one of these, every even or odd number sibling of the type specified, here a TR element, will be selected. This is how we get zebra striping on a table. Take a look at the result. There are many more things we could do, but we've introduced a lot here. You're starting to get a feel for this, hopefully. If not, carefully review the code and the screenshots. Make sure you understand how elements are being selected and how properties are having an effect. This material isn't too hard to get, but there are a lot of little details. Pretty soon, this will be second nature. Forms. Form styling is a little trickier than table styling because forms use widgets, which are standalone applications that can be embedded into third-party sites. They are partly dependent upon the browser and the operating system of the computer you're working with. In this case, the widget is a form control. Let's look quickly at how we might style a simple contact form. We've seen code very similar to this before. One thing we've done differently here is to add placeholder text to the form input fields. Browsers that support this feature, most do now, will insert a helpful prompt provided by the placeholder attribute. This code generates this by default. Let's see how we can use some CSS to make this a little more attractive and a little more accessible. Here is some fresh code. If we apply these styles, this is what we get. Most of this is accomplished using CSS you've already seen. Let's take a look at a few new things. In the form rule, the background property is being specified with a URL data type. By default, if you provide an image to the URL data type, the image is repeated. Here, we've used an image that, when repeated, makes a pleasant and unobtrusive pattern. With the nth child pseudo class, we're providing a little bit of extra margin, so the bottom field set won't bump up too close to the top field set. The legend rule has a nice font variant property that makes small caps. This style provides a little visual distinction. A little padding added to the input and text area elements makes for a nice visual distinction too. Elements are a little less crowded. We could think about pushing the labels away just a little too if we wanted to. We also use the ghost white CSS color keyword a couple of times in order to provide some nice, easy contrast to the background. The form is a little more visually interesting now while remaining easy to use. Finally, we make the font size of the submit button a little larger so that the eye is drawn to it a little more easily. This maintains consistency with the rest of the form too. Styling forms takes time, but it's important to get your forms right. They're a very important user interface, and you'll want to make sure that your users want to use them. That said, the CSS you've seen is enough to make some real improvements to a form. There's a lot more to learn, but you're acquiring some effective skills. Nice! Clarifying your position. CSS positioning. Tables aren't used for web page layout anymore. Instead, most professionals use CSS and different kinds of positioning. By default, a web browser will lay out the elements in an HTML file according to what's called normal flow. We'll come back to that in just a second. So we've talked about the box model. We know that every HTML element is contained by a conceptual box that the browser uses to decide where to put things. Boxes can either behave like block-level elements or inline elements. There are other kinds of elements too, but for now, let's deal with these two types. Block level elements. Most HTML elements are block level, and they behave in the following ways by default. They start a new line on the page. They take up 100% of the space provided by the parent element. They can contain other block level elements, or they can contain inline elements. Think of a stack of blocks, each one sitting on top of another, without allowing for any room for another element to be placed alongside. That's pretty much the way a block level element behaves. Examples of block level elements include the following: div, p, form, field set, section, table, ul, li. There are others too. Inline elements. The terms block and inline almost give away the differences in how these elements work. Inline elements have these characteristics. They only take up as much size as their content. To clarify, unlike block elements that take up 100% of the available space, inline elements are sized according to what they're surrounding. They span the page horizontally until they reach the end of a line, and then they wrap around to the next line. Inline elements, in fact, can be in the middle of a line or just about anywhere. Inline elements can't contain block elements. They're restricted to text or other data or other inline elements. Examples of inline elements include these: A, I, italic formatting; B, bold formatting; label; M, semantic emphasis; text area; IMG; and others. Okay, so let's go back to normal flow. Normal flow elements are displayed basically according to the order they come in the source code, the HTML document itself, and given their block level or inline nature. If they're block elements, they're stacked on the page, each one right below the previous, and each box is given its customary box model dimensions: margin, border, padding, and content. By default, margins will collapse on each other. This means that unless any space between the block level elements is specified with CSS, the boxes will stack right on top of each other. When the browser starts positioning inline elements, it will position them across the page, or the container therein, and will start a new line only when they wrap around. In other words, there's not enough space for the next inline element. If a block level element is encountered, then it will start a new line. This is the normal flow of things. However, if that's all there was, then many beautiful layouts that you've seen on so many websites wouldn't be possible. Let's take a look at a couple of ways to alter the normal flow. Relative positioning. Let's first take a look at relative positioning. Relative positioning allows us to move an element out of the normal flow of the document. What we're going to do is push the element away from where it would normally be placed. So let's say we have a stack of div elements. Now let's give them a little style. We'll make them nice blue boxes, except for one pink box. Here's the CSS. There's nothing really new here. With the margin property, we're putting a little space around the divs, and we're making any text within larger, so we can see the numbers easily. We know that divs are block-level elements, so according to normal flow, these divs will stack on top of each other. Indeed, that's what happens. One of these does not belong. The pink box is out of line. So let's make it out of line. With relative positioning, we can move it to a new location. All we need to do is specify relative positioning and then push the box into its new location. We'll do that by using the top, bottom, left, and right properties. Supplying a unit measure to these properties, in the case we'll specify pixels, will push the div away from the location that the property is named after. Confused? Don't be. All we need to do is change the pink div's CSS. Here's the example. And here's the result. The left property pushed the div 150 pixels from the left. Then we used a negative value on the top property to pull the div up. Can you feel the power at your fingertips? That's all relative positioning is, just moving, really pushing, the element out from its normal flow placement. It's simple, but it's a handy tool that you'll find yourself reaching for pretty often. This, however, is just the beginning. Absolute positioning. Where relative positioning takes into account a document's normal flow, Absolute positioning does not. An absolutely positioned element is removed from the document's normal flow. The element will now be positioned with respect to its nearest positioned ancestor. This is the part that's confusing, so keep reading. By default, an element's position property is unset. So an absolutely positioned element will take a look at its ancestors, the series of elements that contain it, right up to the outermost HTML element. And it will check each of those elements' position property. Is the property set? If so, then the absolutely positioned element will be positioned with respect to that element. Otherwise, it'll continue up the chain until it reaches the HTML element. In other words, the topmost element of the page itself, and it will be positioned with respect to that. Let's take a look. Here's the new CSS. And here's the result. The dot movable div is now given absolute positioning. By default, it's placed where it would normally fall because the browser doesn't know what to do with it yet. Also, there's no margin collapsing, so the top margin is being applied. That's why the div is falling a little lower than the one behind it. No other positioning information has been given. But notice how the 4 div behind it falls right beneath the 2 div? The 4 div is behaving as though the dot movable div isn't there. Now let's give the 3 div a place to go. Try to predict what happens next. The dot movable div is only contained by the HTML element. So when the top and left properties are specified, what happens? The dot movable div is now positioned with respect to the top left of the document. It ignores the elements beneath it. They're a part of the normal flow, and the dot movable div is in a layer of its own above that. We can even change that. The z-index CSS property specifies how elements are placed over each other. The default value of z-index is auto, or 0 if it's unspecified. There are no units, just the numbers. Higher number values are placed over lower number values. Also, the values can be negative. So if we want to place the dot movable div beneath the 1 div, and now, absolute positioning is a wonderful tool, and a big advantage of absolute positioning is its precision. Using absolute positioning is very much like, say, taping an element to a page. Often, that kind of precision is desirable. But there are some disadvantages with absolute positioning. Elements that are positioned in this way are completely removed from the normal flow of the document. This can create maintenance headaches down the line if you decide to add more elements to a document or want to change the layout of a page just a little. Sometimes, managing a document's normal flow and using relative positioning is much easier and elements behave more like you would expect. It's best to use absolute positioning only when you need it, and doing so solves a real problem. Fixed positioning is yet another option. It's essentially the same as absolute positioning, except a fixed positioned element is positioned with respect to the browser window. And there are other ways, too, to arrange elements on the page. But this is a solid and pretty powerful beginning. Modern web layouts are now created with positioning and other options instead of tables. Beginning to understand CSS positioning is an important step toward creating great layouts for your websites. Frameworks. You can start to see how CSS can get to be a bit fiddly. HTML documents can contain many different types of elements. Styling them all with different selectors can be tricky, and getting the CSS just right sometimes takes a while. One answer to this problem is to use an HTML framework. Frameworks provide prepackaged combinations of CSS and JavaScript. We're talking about that next. That can be applied to HTML elements in order to speed up development. Let's take a look at a few popular frameworks and see what they offer. Bootstrap. Bootstrap is an immensely popular CSS framework. Bootstrap provides a lot of things. Responsive components. These are pre-tested CSS rules that allow an HTML element to be viewed well, regardless of context, computer-based web browser, mobile phone, widescreen, or narrow. Pre-configured type classes. These provide consistency across browsers and contexts so that as a developer, you always know where you're starting. You don't have to constantly track what makes one browser just a little bit different from another where text styling is concerned. Components. This includes pre-made buttons, image classes, form elements, and things like image carousels and popover classes that you don't need to find separate libraries for. Using Bootstrap's components can be a huge time saver. Grid system. This is a responsive and flexible set of classes that dramatically speeds up the construction of layouts. SAS. This is an extension to CSS that provides additional capabilities, like CSS variables, mix-ins, operators, and more. Very useful. Foundation. Foundation provides a set of capabilities similar to Bootstrap's. Honestly, many of the features are basically similar to Bootstrap. Foundation does have a slightly different philosophy. Whereas Bootstrap focuses on providing a bunch of tools ready-made, Foundation encourages a more do-it-yourself approach. This means that you're less locked in by the framework's way of doing things, which isn't a bad idea. Pure.css. Pure.css includes a lot of what Foundation and Bootstrap offer, but leaves out the less commonly used or heavier weight components that increase a framework's download size. By keeping the framework small, while still providing the essential elements a developer needs to speed up work, Pure.css becomes more about helping where it's needed rather than dictating or weighing down the development process. All of these frameworks offer many benefits. By providing pre-tested responsive functionality, for example, the development of sites that are meant to be used on mobile devices is dramatically accelerated. Less time, too, is spent reinventing the wheel. Why spend a few days creating an image carousel, for example, when a pre-tested, nicely documented version is already available? But there are some downsides. First of all, by using a framework, it's no longer enough just to have a firm grasp on CSS. You now need to have a firm grasp on the framework. That requires an additional learning period, and if you want to grow your development team, you'll either need to find people who already know the framework or who will have to learn it. Frameworks can be opinionated. That means that they might do things that are a little different from the way you like to do them. Yes, they offer great components, but if your site has a specific way of organizing files or a particular approach to design that you really like, you might need to adjust your philosophy. That can be annoying. Also, frameworks can be heavy. All the extra functionality often comes with a big download. How often have you waited for a website to load and thought, "Gosh, I love waiting for websites to load." Yeah, there can be ways to optimize download speed and size. But for large sites, speed optimization priorities might mean more than whatever benefits a framework provides. In short, frameworks are great, and they have their uses, but you'll sometimes need to decide if they're really right for your site. Knowledge check. By answering these questions, you can test your understanding of new information and uncover any gaps in your knowledge. Reviewing the feedback will help you focus your studying before taking the graded unit quiz. 1. Which statement about CSS is correct? A. CSS was popular in the 1990s, but isn't used much anymore. Incorrect. CSS began in the 1990s, but it is still in wide use. B. CSS 4 is under development. Correct. It isn't universal yet, but it is partially in use. C. CSS 2 was the first version to use modules. Incorrect. CSS 3 was the first version to use modules. D. CSS 1 is currently the most widely used. Incorrect. CSS 3 is the most widely used. 2. Sometimes CSS rules can conflict with each other. When that happens, which rule is followed? A. The rule that uses CSS 4 instead of CSS 3. Incorrect. The version of CSS isn't relevant to which rule is followed. B. The block level rule instead of the inline rule. Incorrect. Block level and inline refer to different ways HTML elements can be arranged on the page, not rule priority. C. The more specific rule instead of the less specific rule. Correct. This is how CSS determines which rule to follow when they conflict. D. Neither, because an error message will be generated. Incorrect. This is not how CSS works. 3. What is one of the main differences between block elements and inline elements? A. Inline elements must use inline style. Incorrect. The words are the same, but inline elements don't require inline style. B. Block elements can only appear in tables. Incorrect. A table is a block element, but there are many other block elements that don't have to interact with tables. C. Inline elements don't always begin on a new line, but block elements do. Correct. That's the basic difference between a block element and an inline element. D. Block elements don't always begin on a new line, but inline elements do. Incorrect. In fact, it is precisely the opposite that is true. Conclusion. Hopefully, now you can see the relationship between HTML's structural definition and the presentational rules that CSS provides. Separating these concerns allows for more complicated and ultimately more powerful websites. And for sure, CSS is powerful stuff. We've only gotten started here. CSS is capable of quite a lot more, especially when combined with JavaScript's programming power. Once you see how that final piece of the web trio fits in, you'll start to understand why some pretty amazing applications are built with these technologies.